Call the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are.
It's a serious question.
I appreciate your passion. I share it. I've addressed this question. I've addressed my personal feelings.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news.
You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with our weekly review of the news, Just Ask the Press. With me, as always, is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and current editor-at-large from CQ Roll Call, John Bennett. Today, we got a lot to unpack. Man, it's been a busy week. I don't know about anybody else. Have you ever seen a busier week? Yes, that's right. Last night, the guy known for his sarcastic comedy, Matthew Perry, died, apparently drowned in his own hot tub. But that's not the top of the news. We've got a new speaker in town. Who is he? That would be Mr. Johnson. Government shutdown looms. Is the GOP band back together? The ground war has been launched in Gaza as U.S. hits targets in Syria, who were prompted by Iranian influence, we understand. There's been a mass shooting in Tampa overnight, but there was a mass shooting in Maine. And nothing is done about that again. Meanwhile, in the Donald Trump case, he's been sanctioned $10,000 for violating his gag order. Smith wants to reintroduce another gag order. Donald Trump may be off the ballot in Colorado. At least that's what he's telling his followers. And Michael Cohen testifies in New York while Donald Trump runs off in a huff. So that's the busy news. We could spend an hour on that. But meanwhile, don't forget, Mike Pence drops out of the race for president, and few people even knew he was in it. Joe Biden has a new challenger. And finally, in good news, the Beatles released their last single ever. So that's a lot to unpack in a week, and we have a lot of questions. Stick around. We'll be right back.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth. With Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not released anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with our weekly news in review show, Just Ask the Press. And I guess I'll just start out asking you, John, as our former Capitol Hill reporter extraordinaire, who is the new speaker and what can he do, if anything? The floor is yours, my brother.
Well, we didn't know a lot about Mike Johnson.
Even know who the hell he was. I'm going to be honest with you. I texted that to you.
Who
the hell is this guy?
You did. And what we learned as these things happen, he was, I guess we can call him the consensus candidate that emerged. House Republicans, they just wanted something different. And, you know, they cycled through Kevin McCarthy and then the majority leader, the number two, Steve Scalise, was the speaker nominee after McCarthy was ousted. Excuse me. And then Jim Jordan, who's a prominent name on Fox News and Newsmax and Fox Business and all that. And he's the judiciary chairman. He's, you know, been leading the charge with James Comer on investigating Biden and his son, Hunter Biden. And he's a big name, but Republicans didn't want that either. Moderates didn't want Jordan. Far right didn't want Scalise and McCarthy. Tom Emmer, who's the number three Republican, he's in leadership. Everyone's mad at leadership. Within the Republican conference, they talk about the five families or five major groups.
The five families.
Yeah. For different reasons. For different reasons, big numbers of all those families were mad at leadership. Sometimes for completely contradictory reasons. So it wasn't going to be anyone from leadership. That became clear. Really, Really after Scalise, I think that was clear, but they have a hierarchy and they went through the hierarchy and it was noisy and chaotic. And, you know, Scalise didn't even get to the floor with his candidacy. It lasted a couple hours and then he was out. So that's basically it. They all wanted something different, and enter Mike Johnson. And as the Matt Gaetzes of the world call him, MAGA Mike Johnson. And he is true blue. True red. MAGA red, that is. And he's from Louisiana. He's a Southern lawyer. And I'll let readers decide or listeners decide how they can define that on their own. I've known a couple Southern lawyers. I know you have too, Brian.
Yeah.
So, and what we've learned about Mr. Johnson, Speaker Johnson, is he's very conservative. He's very religious, which is fine and good. A lot of people in America, polls show, still say at least that they like their church and state separate. We'll see how much his religion seeps into whatever agenda now the House is going to pursue. He hates large spending bills. We were talking before we hit the button to record. He's the best I can tell, since he was sworn in 2017. He's never voted for what's called an omnibus spending package, which is when lawmakers will put together 2, 4, or all 12 annual appropriations bills into one big bill. And that's a way to pass them quickly. Usually at the end of the year, more on this coming up, I believe. Usually at the end of the year is when they'll do that, right before the holidays, pass a big bill and you know, fund the government until September and get out of town, go open presents and watch football. Well, what we're learning about Mr. Johnson is, you know, he talks about he has a biblical worldview, and he's described America as a moral country, that we've lost our way, and he's anti-gay marriage. It kind of seems like he's anti-LGBTQ plus people in general. He believes, you know, all of that is a sin according to the Christian Bible. And basically says that America, while yes, we're a nation of laws, need to be ruled more by biblical teachings and what's in the Bible. And I know a lot of people have problems with that already. There people are calling him, a far right extremist, not just a far right extremist. So he's very different than Kevin McCarthy. McCarthy is more along the lines of, the best anyone has ever been able to tell, because he does shift and change his political stripes, something like a chameleon, but he is fundamentally more like a country club Republican, like a Mitch McConnell Republican.
Yeah.
Mr. Johnson is not that. Mr. Johnson, he's more of your evangelical type conservative Republican. And I'm not sure how that applies to leading a conference with 5 very different groups, including several big moderate groups in places where, you know, good old Southern down home evangelicalism, that doesn't apply in places like, you know, upstate New York or, you know, Mike Lawler's district. That's not the same. So we knew it would be hard for anybody to unify this conference, bring it together, lead it, pass legislation, and set an agenda. And you know, I think it's going to be tough for Mr. Johnson to do that. It would have been tough for anybody to do that. Don't get me wrong, but some of what we're learning, I'm just not sure he's going to be the best fit. Not that anybody could be for
are we going to go to a government shutdown, do you think, on this November 17th?
The Senate and President Biden, I think, to avoid a shutdown, they would have to be the ones to give here. And I don't think a continuing resolution is completely out of the realm of possibility, but Democrats in the Senate, even Senate Republicans, like to spend, oh, by the way, and President Biden will probably have to accept that CR at some kind of lower level. Maybe not all the way to what the conservatives in the House want, but they might have to take this one on the chin to keep the government open for a few more weeks or a few more months.
Michael, my question for you is, there's a great deal of concern among, well, let's start with this. Johnson isn't more conservative than the Republicans of yesteryear. As CNN reports, the Republicans have just become, you know, far more conservative, right? Hal Rogers, who was first elected in 1980 and is the longest serving House Republican incumbent, was more conservative than 59% of the GOP members during his first term. Now he's more moderate than 80% of House Republicans. That being said, that tells you where the Republicans have gone. Their concern, there is a legitimate concern about the blending of church and state. And in fact, there are members, there are supporters of Johnson and the Republican conservatives who say that there is no separation of church and state. So I'm going to just read the First Amendment, which says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. That's a lot of freedoms that seem to be covered in the First Amendment. And so they're saying, his supporters are saying, there is no separation of church and state. And in fact, we are a Christian nation. How do you, you're my go-to guy for the law, brother. So unpack that for me.
Well, the founders of the country were all pretty much all religious people. And they did believe it was, you know, one nation under God. That wasn't accidental. But the First Amendment makes clear what, even if you are a God-fearing Christian, it means to not impose that will on a secular government, which is our government. So the First Amendment says that you can't make laws that favor one religion over another or punish one or prohibit the free exercise of your religion. So it's not that people can't be God-fearing Christians in our country as the founders was. It just means that you can't make any laws abridging rights or interfering with other people's rights. I don't believe in all things that other religious groups believe in. I believe in my religious tenets, and I have the right to believe that. I don't have the right, and no one has the right to impose on me their beliefs. Now, the tricky part with Johnson, like Pence, is that they believe that our, you know, laws should derive from sort of the deity. And that's just not the way it works. The laws derive from Congress. You know, one's religious belief can inform the types of legislation they want to see passed, but we don't derive our authority from the Christian Bible. And Johnson, let me just read you a paragraph. It says, Julian Zelizar, the Princeton historian, wrote a piece. And he says, on almost every issue, Johnson is hard right. He has been a staunch opponent of same-sex marriage. He has been at the forefront of opposing reproductive rights. He opposed funding for Ukraine. He wants to deregulate the economy, cut taxes, deny the very real problems facing the climate. He supports expunging former President Donald Trump's second impeachment, questioned the Justice Department for how it's handled Biden's investigation, and most importantly, was at the center of the effort to overturn the 2020 election, all of which you would think, you know, would inform moderate Republicans, but he was elected unanimously, I believe, right, as Speaker. And so you don't know whether this was just exhaustion on the part of the moderates, recognizing they just had to use one of the phrases of a Republican, put this clown show, you know, behind us. Dan Pfeffer, the former Obama political person, wrote a piece saying, is this good news for the Democrats? Meaning, do they now have someone to run against? Can they sort of wrap up the Republican Party, not only with Donald Trump, for what he stands for or doesn't stand for, but with Johnson, to say this is this is who they are now. This person, the list of positions that I just read out, is who he is. And that's not where America is. You know, right. Polling indicates that people support same-sex marriage. People support reasonable gun control. People support LGBTQ rights more broadly than just gay marriage. They have lots of issues with his climate denying positions. And so, you know, maybe it is that the Republicans have shown who the current day Republicans are, and the Democrats now have an opportunity to say, let's compare and contrast. You've got Joe Biden, who may be old.
He is old, but
but this is what he stands for.
Yeah.
And then you've got Joe, and then you've got Donald Trump, who seems
also old.
I've been watching some of his speeches, and he seems to flub as many words as Biden, maybe more. And now leader, whatever the hell he's called, Johnson, who stands for all of these things. So people, you know, pays your money, takes your chance. You know, who do you want? What do you want? Well, so maybe it is, you know, maybe it is good. Now, whether or not the announcement that by the Minnesota congressman whose name Dean Phillips undermines Biden is a question to be taken up later. I can say is a question to be taken up later. So I think you've got pretty stark contrast now between who the Republicans are in Congress, at least in the House, who their leading candidate is, and what the alternatives are. So it's bad for the country, but maybe short-term good for 2024 Democrats.
Well,
as I sit here in Santos's district, which is where my mom lives.
God bless you.
His office is just down the street.
Lord. Well, we'll get
it. I may get it for your upcoming Christmas gifts. I may get you guys reelect Santos buttons.
There you go.
Yeah,
that'll be a collector's
bumper
item.
Sticker.
But
you know, Jake Tapper in his office at CNN has political signs of people who ran for office. You know those things, and I've he's got the signs of right. I think every unsuccessful presidential candidate. That's what his.
I have Nixon is the one. But let me put a
– He want, was the one.
I want to put a bow on this for a second, just because this issue I've seen in social media. I've seen it on the news. I've heard it discussed in many places. But it was Madison who said that we do have a separation of church and state simply to avoid the bloodshed that had happened in Europe over many centuries. And the Establishment Clause, and you're my legal guy, just tell me if I'm wrong, but the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment does prohibit the government from making any law, quote, respecting an establishment of religion. So this clause not only forbids the government from establishing an official religion, but also prohibits government actions that unduly favor one religion or another. Yes? I mean,
yeah, that's what I tried to say. They can't. My religious freedom extends to my religious beliefs and yours to yours. And no government shall say Brian's view, God forbid, Brian's view of religion should be imposed on me. I'll take Bennett's, you know, who wouldn't want an evangelical North Carolinian worldview? but seriously, that's the point.
They may have had Christian beliefs. I mean, look, many of them.
You can believe whatever you want to believe, but they don't. That because they're in the New Testament, doesn't make it so.
Well, and it doesn't make it part of your Christian belief. Most of the founding fathers described themselves as deists. They believed in God, but not necessarily a religion. And those that did believe in a religion said You know, like John Adams, the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. The belief in God is different from the belief in a Christian religion. I mean, there are 14,000 different religions and gods on the planet. So while they believed in God, they didn't believe that a nation should be founded on Christianity. And that's
what I said. That's what I was trying to say. Brian. The same thing. You could be a God-fearing Christian. You can believe in God, but that doesn't mean God's laws, as you interpret them, apply on earth.
Right. Okay. Well, with that wrapped
just
up.
Brian, yeah. Sorry, just want to jump in. I found a October 27th of last year, Pew Research Center poll that found 2/3 of U.S. adults say churches should keep out politics. It's 2/3.
Yeah.
and I guess that's to Pfeffer's point, which is if you've got a person who takes his direction from the Bible, his Bible, not mine, and believes that God's laws should be, you know, our, you know, statutory laws, and you've got him supporting Donald Trump, a threat to democracy, then you've got a good compare and contrast. And, except that you've got Robert Kennedy Jr. And maybe Dean Phillips.
Yeah.
And
don't get me started. I think of every time you say Dean Phillips, I think of Rodney Dangerfield's Back to School, and I'm looking for Dean Martin. But different Dean. So but the idea of religion weighs heavily in our next particular discussion, and that is the ground war that's launched in Gaza. U.S. has hit targets in Syria.
Israel has. U.S.
Israel is on the ground in Gaza. There is no there's no cell service or internet service, and you know, an area where 2 million people live, and 50,000 of them are supposed to be Hamas fighters. This situation seems to be getting out of control quickly. And I'll be the first to say, look, I remember, I vaguely remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I look at the world situation, and I remember the Vietnam War very well. And I look at this world situation today. I think this is the closest to the cliff we've been in quite a while, with wars raging not only in Africa, but in Ukraine, and now in Israel and the Middle East, and this is threatening to spread quickly. Michael, you want to help unpack some of that?
I wish I knew what was going on in Israel. You know, there are certain facts. Israel was attacked by Hamas brutally, in ways that the criminality of which is unspeakable.
Yes.
And Israel, properly, I think, has a right to defend itself against that, and has taken action, and is taking action against Hamas. The problem is, as is the case in all war, is that there are civilian casualties, people who are just trying to get on with their lives and be, you know, left alone, and they're suffering mightily. And it's hard to say, well, you know, Israel is to blame for that, and they have to put a ceasefire into effect. And I just think, what would the United States or any nation state have done if similarly attacked? We saw what we did when we were attacked in 9/11. 9/11, remember, the number of people died compared to the number of people who died in the Israel attack, I think as a matter of the percentage of population, it would have been about 44,000 deaths in the US.
Right.
So essentially 44,000 people were killed as a
comparative
matter of the population. Yeah. And so 10 times less, and we invade Iraq and Afghanistan, countries that really had nothing to do with 9/11. It's very hard for me to say Israel can't do this, but I do recognize the horror that the people, the innocent people of Gaza are suffering. But I don't know what the solution to it is. I know that
my question be awfully is there nice. Another path.
No, I was going to say it'd be awfully nice if Egypt was part of the solution.
Yeah,
that they opened the gates so that you could get they don't want the refugee crisis. Egypt doesn't want a refugee crisis.
Why don't they prosecute the Hamas crisis? I mean, if you're going to really do it. But my question is
Brian.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It just seems to me that there's a pox in everybody's house, but to simply say this is on Israel, what's going on in Gaza is on Israel is just, I don't think, a fair reflection of the geopolitics of that region. The Jordanians don't want to really be part of the solution for the Palestinians. The Egyptians don't want to be part of the Palestinian solution. They certainly don't want to be part of the help the Gazans, the innocent Gazans flee the war zone by opening the gate. That would make it much safer. But yet Israel bears the bulk of it. And sure, everyone would like to see the end of innocent people suffering.
Well,
it's not simple for me.
No, it's not. But you bring up a point, and John, I want your take on this. I mean, you and I both know a fellow by the name of Trey Yingst, who was in the White House at the beginning of the Trump administration, is now a Middle East war correspondent for Fox, and he tweeted out something: there, in this situation, there is no room for the fog of war. Yet you and I both know that, and even the president has said, and this administration and many others, and to your point, Michael, we don't know what's going on. We can't trust the news or the information coming out of the region. There are people that are now, there were people posting on social media that, from the Palestinians, I wish I had kissed my loved one. This was the last time I saw him. They were killed indiscriminately. I think there's criticism to be had on both sides, and I want to dance around. I don't want to dance around this, but I don't want people to misunderstand what it is that I'm saying. And that is, yes, Hamas was wrong. Yes, there are innocent people dying, and the Palestinians have to be considered. Sure, Israel has a right to defend itself, but the criticism of Israel is are they beating people over the head? Is there a better way for them to do it? And I'm not a politician. I don't understand geopolitics. I don't think anybody in that region does, but I think that, and I don't think anybody in the world does, because I think there's a nuance there that's missing because the facts are missing. We know there are people dead on both sides. We know that Israel has the upper hand as far as the IDF is far more powerful than Hamas, and Hamas takes advantage of that by basically holding the innocent civilians of Palestine hostage. And I don't think there's anybody that'll disagree that Palestinians have little help anywhere in the world, basically because they don't have a lot of, they have no oil. They have nothing that they want that can be sold. They are basically the downtrodden. I don't find, if you can't find sympathy with the Palestinians, the innocent Palestinians, I find it almost impossible to have, related sympathy with you. But that's not saying that Israel is wrong to defend itself. Help me out, John. I'll go on endlessly.
Well, but
it's the fog of war, right? It's that there's a lot of disinformation, is my point.
Sure. That is the nature of war. I agree with what Michael said about, I don't know either what's going on inside Gaza or Israel. Preface it with that. This is a centuries old problem that has never been fully solved. And what Hamas did was obviously brutal and, unforgivable, and every other negative description that any of us could come up with probably doesn't do the brutality justice.
Yeah, the president said pure evil. I agree with that.
It was pure evil. Some of the things that we've heard and seen, and our friend Trey has posted some videos when the IDF has taken reporters into some of these the kibbutzes and, you know, the homes and other places where the Hamas, I don't even want to call them troops, terrorists, went in and slaughtered innocent Israelis. And, you know, the very powerful pictures and images from Trey, really proud of him. He's doing a great job over there.
He's and a great guy.
Just hope he stays safe. Yeah, great guy. So, but one thing that I do think is fair for the rest of the world, especially the West, the US, France, the Brits, the others who have influence for various reasons over the Israelis, at what point is their response? And it's hard to say, but I don't have a definition of what is proportional for something like this. You know, that's not to brag. I do have the advanced degree in security studies. And, you know, that's what our instructors and professors and guest speakers and all the literature that we read, you know, you want your response to be proportional and not over the line for all number of reasons. But, you know, I don't have a definition of what's proportional for what Hamas did. And I think that is adding to the fog of this war. No one knows what is proportional here. Is there, but I think it's fair and a healthy role for Joe Biden and Emmanuel Macron and others to play, to ask the Israelis, okay, you could blow up that, you could launch a cruise missile or fighter strikes on that high rise. And we know that there are 50 to 110 civilians inside. And I know you want to get those two bad guys. We want to get them too. Is there another way to do that?
Yeah.
Instead of taking down the whole building, I think that is a healthy role for the U.S. to play. And I think, frankly, I think the Israelis need that. I think they're understandably upset. I'm upset about.
I would be pissed.
Everyone is. But I do think there are 8,000. There are 8,000. Well, I know these are Gaza Health Ministry numbers, and that's basically run by Hamas, but their number is 8,005 people dead inside Gaza as of this morning. At what point is it not proportional? But again, I understand, like you said, Bronick, you both said, Israel has a right to defend itself, and any country would, as Michael said. But, you know, as that number approaches in another month, as that number approaches 20,000, even if we have reasons to suspect it's inflated, if 20,000 means 14,000 still, like, you know, at what point here, you know, I don't want to say what's enough's enough, but is there another way? If you can get those special forces in there and you're not taking down high rises, but I understand, you know, he has a responsibility to keep his troops as safe as they can when they do get further and further inside Gaza. Well, this is a puzzle that might not, it doesn't seem solvable.
But again,
like Michael said, I mean, Hamas did this.
It's not a military solution alone. There has to be a political solution. We talked last week about should the Macrons and Bidens of the world be convening a Camp David styled global
conversation
about the political solution here, because the Palestinians have a right to their own state. What the geography of that state looks like is complicated, with Gaza being separated from the West Bank. Is Israel going to give up territory so that they have a continuous lane of transportation in between it? But who is the political party that will run this state? Is it Mahmoud Abbas? Is he capable of running a state? Is he a nation state leader? What role will Hamas, if any, have in this new state? Who is it that the world can look to govern this state? That's an important question. You know, Israel has said for a long time, we have no peace partner. I don't necessarily believe that. I think that Arafat could have been a police partner. I think Abbas can be a peace
partner.
But that's got to be sorted out. because otherwise, you know, Hamas will continue to be the terrorist force that it is, and you can, you know, win today's war, and you can be like Afghanistan. Look, what we invaded Afghanistan a decade or so ago, to rid it of Taliban and the influences there that gave safe haven to Al Qaeda and stuff. And now, 10 years later, they're in charge.
Yeah.
Again, to what end? So I think the questions that have to be asked of Netanyahu, who shouldn't be the prime minister after the security failure on his
watch. Should not be.
Yeah. Should not be. The question for Netanyahu is, you know, what's your end game? Not this short term, blow up bunkers and try to take out the leadership of Hamas, but what's your end game? Because the reality is that probably this bombing campaign is radicalizing a whole next generation of Hamas leaders. You know, if the Hamas leaders are in their kids, in their 20s.
The young kids who are living there suffering.
The 12-year-olds will 12-year-olds become the 20-year-olds, and then you've got a new generation of when I was a narcotics prosecutor, one of the reasons we started switching from prosecuting following the money and prosecuting the money launderers as opposed to the drug traffickers was that there was an endless number of drug traffickers.
They'll never fill the gap.
And so always someone was willing, because the people who were mules especially come from very tough economic circumstances. So they're willing to take the chance. And there was an unending supply of them. So going after the drug mules was senseless. It made no sense. There was always going to be another one. So you had to go after the financiers because money, drugs were replaceable. There's too much drugs as it is. But money was the lifeblood of the organization. So it went out for the money launderers. So similarly here, you know, there's an unending pool of people who can fill the next generation of Hamas fighters. So right. You have to figure out what's the political solution. And I'm not about to tell Israel what's in its best interest. I have no idea what the hell is going on in that part of the world. People who sit on the TV and pontificate about Israel should do this and Israel should do that. I think my experience in watching them is they don't know anything about what the reality on the ground is for Israel than all of us who have confessed complete ignorance. And probably we should move on to the next segment of the show because I'm talking to three people who have said they don't know anything about anything. They keep droning on.
Before we hit break, we got to go to a break here real quick, but I just want a simple answer to this question. It is short and concise as both of you can make it. Here's the question. Biden has been given grief for his apparent, according to some of the criticism, that he has not shown enough compassion for the innocent Palestinians. Do you believe that criticism is accurate, John?
Well, I just think there's so much blame to go around here. And
do you think it's correct to criticize him for it?
Criticize Netanyahu?
The president.
Oh,
he has said, now mind you, he has said he has sympathy for the innocents. He believes in a two-state solution, but he has not done enough to emphasize that, according to his critics. Real simple question, yes or no? Do you think that he deserves that criticism?
What happened to Empathy Joe?
Yeah, well.
Why doesn't it apply to the Gazans? How's that for concise?
There you go. How about you, Michael?
I believe that Biden has been pretty clear that he thinks the suffering of innocents in Gaza and elsewhere is bad, and he would like to see an end to it. And I think that he worked hard when he went to Israel to try to talk Netanyahu into being more restrained. But Israel will determine what's in Israel's best interest, whether we agree to it or not. I mean, there's 500,000, you know, Palestinian refugee types in London, protesting. So that's not, you know, that's true in France too. There's, you know, an expatriate Palestinian community all over the place, because all the countries that surround Palestine haven't wanted them in their countries.
Right.
So I think that Biden has been pretty clear about it. And we'll see as this phase two of the war in against Hamas proceeds, what Biden will say if we see, you know, pictures of escalating innocent damage. I mean, I think he's been pretty clear. He's not gonna satisfy everybody.
We're gonna go to break with that. I'll say it this way. I think once again he could underline his support for the innocent Palestinians. I feel this is a failure of communication on the staff to underline that. Other than that, Empathy Joe, I think, is there, and I do believe he does care. But I think it's a communication problem that the White House suffers from time to time, and it comes to raise its hoary little head whenever issues of import.
I'll just add one more thing, if I could, Brian. To your point, the Biden team has at times just been all over the map communicating about this very part.
Yeah, horrible.
And there's no consistency. They contradict each other. And it's just, it adds to, like I said, this unsolvable perhaps problem.
And with that, we'll take a short break. We'll come back with more fun news, mass shootings. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not found anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. I'm your host, Brian Karen, with our weekly update of the news of the day, Just Ask the Press. And in our latest episode, our latest issue to tackle is there have been, let me put it this way. It took a hurricane, a Category 5 hurricane, to kill 40 people in Acapulco. And we managed to do that in several mass shootings in just the last few days in the United States. I guess you could say that the property damage was less in the U.S., but it merely took three or four mass shootings to amass that same death record in the U.S., starting with one in Maine, then the latest one, which took 18 or so lives. There was one in Tampa overnight that took a few lives. There are many injured. And then I was again on Capitol Hill this week, and both the House and the Senate, Democrat and Republican, say the same things and do absolutely fucking, sorry for that, nothing. And it's been that way for a long, long time. In fact, I was in an event Thursday night as this was unfolding in Maine, where people were cheering the acquisition of many guns, not just a gun, but many guns, as it was pointed out that this reservist in Maine had mental health issues. And once again, Michael, I'll let you lead off.
But he bought a gun lawfully. I mean, that's the thing that stood out to me most. Here's a guy with, you know,
most of them are bought lawfully.
No, I understand, but but this is the point. Here's a guy with, quote unquote, a publicly known history of mental illness, who under the laws of Maine and the United States can buy a gun. I mean, what's wrong with that picture? It just strikes me. And the congressman from Maine, who finally, when the killings were on his doorstep, said, you know, I think I'm going to change my vote and vote for gun control now. I mean, really? Really? Yeah. After all of these mass shootings all over the country for the last decade, now all of a sudden you realize that, well, maybe it's time for gun control. Please. It's embarrassing. I'm glad that he's changing his vote, but he should be embarrassed. He said he was embarrassed. But for God's sakes, if we can't change these laws with this false notion that the Second Amendment does not allow for the reasonable regulation of guns, is idiocy. It's just idiocy. It doesn't impair your right to bear arms. It just imposes conditions for the acquisition. You have a right to drive a car theoretically, but you're not going to have a driver's license. It's just, it's mind-numbing.
Well, it was Warren Berger, I believe, or Earl Warren, maybe it was both, who said that, you know.
Maybe it was Earl Berger.
Yeah, maybe it was Hamburger. He said that the Second Amendment doesn't say what they think it says. I'll read it. It says, a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. To me, that sounds like we're talking about the National Guard. And not individuals. And yet this is an argument that's gone on for 200 years, I suppose, but you know, weapons now are, it'd be different if they were walking around with a musket, but you know, which you have to tamp in and shoot and then, you know, reload. And it takes a minute. Whereas, you know, you got an AK or an AR-15 or something with bump stocks that can fire multiple rounds in a minute. That's completely freaking different. And yet we do not. Why? All right, this is for you, John, as succinctly as you can put it. Why the hell don't we do anything about it on Capitol Hill when 70% of the people polled say they want something done?
A number of reasons. The gun lobby, the NRA and others are very powerful, especially within Republican circles. But also there are still purple districts that are right now represented by, especially in the House, by Democrats, and you know, hunting and Second Amendment is important there too. So it's not just Republicans. Democrats are also, some Democrats feel pressure from the gun lobby. It's also this idea of purity on a number of issues, and the Second Amendment is in God the top, probably the top two, if not the top three of those issues. And you have to be pure. You can't, there's no nuance there. It's the Second Amendment. Aside from bump stocks and automatic weapons. And I'm sure that if you poll House Republicans with a little truth serum, you could probably get into the 70s on, you know, wanting automatic weapons to be legal. But we don't have any truth serum and I'm not a pollster, so we're not going to do that. Yeah, but the Second Amendment purists, they worship the amendment. They got to be pure on it, but it's as if two words in the Second Amendment don't even exist, and that's right. Well regulated militia, well regulated. They kind of just breeze past that part, and it's all, it shouldn't be regulated at all. Gun sales, I'll add, in Maine, went way up after this shooting because of a fear, and they always do in wherever this state is, excuse me, out of a fear that, you know, Democrats are going to come take my guns. So I better.
Which they've never done.
Right. They've never done. So, you know, narrator voice would say right now, if this was Arrested Development, these laws aren't going to change.
Yeah. All right.
And I'll just, one thing about it, you were joking in our brief break between segments about the news and how uplifting it is. I was watching one of the cable networks Thursday or Friday, and they went from a reporter in Israel with the rocket sirens going off, and you could see explosions in the background, through it to a reporter in Maine waiting on a law enforcement to give an update on the shooting there and what was still a manhunt for the shooter. And then that reporter threw it to the studio, who threw it to Mexico to update everyone on the death toll from the hurricane there. So, I mean, this is relentless anymore. It's every day. The news cycle is just more and more depressing. And it's just,
well, to your point, here's two things that depressed the hell out of me. All of that news came through, and then Marjorie Taylor Greene says there's devastation in Mexico. Why hasn't it been reported? And I asked her, well, how did you find out about it if it wasn't reported, you dumbass? and then secondly, you know, all of this stuff is going on in the Middle East, and you have Donald Trump coming out wanting to reimpose the Muslim ban. So the nonsense is unending, and I don't even know where to go with it. But I mean, at the end of the day, I guess we'll go with segueing into the Donald Trump problem.
Can I just say one thing as your so-called legal analyst, and I emphasize so-called. on the Second Amendment question, you said that it's a right that's been sort of sacred. But the reality is, of course, that probably this was intended as a militia forming organization, right. But the Supreme Court has opined on it in Heller and McDonald and some other cases, which said that there is a limited right to bear arms. But what's important to remember about the landmark case of District of Columbia versus Heller, which was this guy Dick Heller sues DC over its handgun ban at home, an outright ban, and the court ruled that individuals have a right to keep handguns at home for self-protection. But Justice Scalia, the late Justice Scalia, the champion of conservatism and originalism, who wrote the decision, Scalia says, and I'll quote his language, he says, like most rights, the right secured by the Second Amendment is not unlimited. It is not a right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever in any manner whatsoever and for whatever purpose. And he provided examples that would be laws that would be presumptively lawful, which prohibit the firearm in the possession of dangerous people, which forbid firearm possession in certain sensitive places, schools and government buildings, which would impose conditions on the commercial sale of firearms. He said all of those things would be constitutional because the Second Amendment right, like all other rights secured by the Constitution, are not unlimited and not for whatever purpose, in whatever manner, in whatever way any individual sees fit. So there is a ton of room for states and federal government to pass legislation consistent with the Second Amendment if there is a political will. And it seems that there is always hand-wringing and prayers and may your memory be a blessing sort of stuff after a shooting.
Yeah, and then they default
right away to, yes, but don't ask me to vote against my personal political interests by imposing handgun restrictions, because that would be bad for me.
Yeah, because I won't get the NRA money that I wanted. Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
Legally, it's there. Justice Scalia has said it.
What was the opinion? Clearly, again?
The decision is in District of Columbia versus Heller. That was the big landmark case. And then there was another one called McDonald versus City of Chicago. Those are the big Supreme Court cases on Second Amendment, which says you can't have blanket prohibitions, but you can make reasonable limitations on
John's point,
acquisition.
Well regulated is right there in the Constitution. So, and we don't regulate. Anyway, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to get right into Donald Trump. Oh boy. Stick around, more fun when we return.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with our weekly roundup, Just Ask the Press. And so in the weekly news roundup, a lot of, you know, Donald Trump is way down. I know this has probably got him all upset, but, you know, he's just not the top news anymore. But he was sanctioned $10,000 for shooting his mouth off when he shouldn't have. Jack Smith wants to reinstitute the gag order. Donald Trump may lose in Colorado, and he's putting out all kinds of feelers to his friends and I guess his supporters, asking for more money to fight that. And in New York, Michael Cohen testified against him, which caused Donald Trump to run off in a huff. Look, right now, Donald Trump is facing losing a shitload of money in New York. It's not up for grabs as to whether or not he's been fined liable for fraud. There's a summary judgment there. The arguments in New York are simply over how much money he's going to have to give the state of New York. He could lose all of his holdings there. He could be off the ballot in Colorado if this case goes forward, which could lead to other cases against him. And then meanwhile, he's still facing 91 felony charges. That's the topper. Michael, I'm going to let you unload all of this.
Well, there's a lot going on.
There always is with damn Donnie.
So there is the Letitia James New York civil lawsuit. Last week, the headlines was Michael Cohen to testify, and then he testified, I think, over a two-day period. The first day went, the direct examination sort of went in pretty smoothly. The cross-examination was anything but smooth, with Cohen taking the bait from Trump's lawyers and arguing with her. And she'd ask a question and he'd say, that was asked and answered. And that's a ruling from a judge, not from a person on the witness stand. So the lawyers had their hands full with Cohen. Trump was none too pleased. And as you said, he lashed out and got a $10,000 fine, which the people who buy his MAGA hats will
pay for.
Support. But what was really interesting was that the people who were almost the most important people in the courtroom were the people who have to bring the next case where Cohen is going to be the key witness, which is the Stormy Daniels hush money case. And as they sit there watching Cohen as witness, now in this case, he's a little bit more peripheral. He's relevant to the insurance fraud stuff. He's important to show what Trump knew and his state of mind, less so for the main part of the case, which has been resolved by summary judgment. But in the hush money case, he is one of, he and the guy from media, Becker. I knew it was one of
David,
those.
It's like David Pecker.
David Pecker is probably the more important witness, but
thank Cohen God his first name isn't Richard. We'd be making all kinds of bad jokes.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to let that be. But Pecker is probably the more important witness in that case. But Cohen is a critical witness in that case. And so if you're the lawyers who have to put him on the stand, and if you're the lawyers who get to cross him, all of whom were in the courtroom, yeah, they were all watching. All of them came in, two of Trump's lawyers and one of the lead counsel for Bragg's office. I think her name is Hoffinger. They had to be scratching their heads like, what have I got here? But the bottom line is the case is proceeding. Cohen is off the witness stand, but of course back on TV predicting stuff. I just don't get it. It's like he's got an irresistible impulse to be, you know, on TV. But surprised that Lanny Davis has him out so prominently. But
yeah,
So the shorter answer to your question is Trump has a hissy fit, gets fined $10,000. Meanwhile, the case seems to be proceeding according to plan and will result in a verdict against Trump. And we'll see what the amount of damages
Do you think that they'll just grant? I mean, what's your thoughts there? I know that you've dealt with
the judge issues a ruling, Brian. It's a judge trial.
Yeah.
And the judge is hearing all the evidence and he's going to say on the main count, that which he already gave a directed verdict on, that because he found liability for a pattern of fraudulent behavior, he's just going to set the amount of damages. Then there's insurance and other fraud counts that haven't been resolved by directed verdict that he's got to decide whether the evidence supports conviction, but it's a civil case, judgment in favor of Ms. James's office. And if so, what amount of money is or what the sanction is for that. So that's what's going on here. You know, the other thing about Cohen, as you watch the case, and you think, well, you know, this is a judge trial. So the judge, you know, is wise to the antics of defense counsel. So did you lie then or did you lie now? You know, that sort of question. And he admitted where he lied, which is sort of, you know, unfortunate, but that's who he is.
Yeah.
But in a jury trial setting, those sort of displays sometimes are more sellable to a juror. Who can say, like, I just find Michael Cohen to be a bald-faced liar, and I'm not going to believe anything he says about anything. And then he's just sort of wiped off the.
Now, what about Colorado? But I mean, that's
completely. So that's that. So Colorado, the case is proceeding. Jane Raskin, who was Donald Trump's lead lawyer in the Mueller investigation, I think, is leading the. Case there in Colorado, and she's a brilliant lawyer, and I have to say, for transparency purposes, a lifelong friend of mine and my wife and her husband Marty. But the what's at play there is the 14th Amendment, third section of the 14th Amendment said anyone who engages in an insurrection shall not be allowed to be part of the government. That was directed at the Confederates, those who left the Union. They were not allowed back in. They couldn't hold office again unless they did certain conditions. But the regulation was passed for that purpose. And now what they're saying is that Trump did the same thing. He engaged in an act of insurrection or supported an insurrection, and therefore he should not be allowed to hold office pursuant to the 14th Amendment. And that's what's being litigated. What does it mean is the question before the court. What does it mean to engage in or support insurrection?
And
it's not defined. If you're convicted of it, that's easy. If you're a Confederate who swore an allegiance to another country that was at war with the Union, that's pretty easy. But if you were a cheerleader to the mob of January 6th, is that insurrection? As the Constitution intended it.
Cheerleader. That's
no, I understand that. Even if you were the ring leader of it, if you've not been convicted of it, what standard shall you apply to determine whether you supported an insurrection? Has anyone been convicted?
No.
I guess a couple of people have been convicted of seditious conspiracy. But I'm not sure that those people who convicted of suspicious, seditious conspiracy can be tied back directly to Trump. Can. And so how do they tie it back? These are the questions that the court has to answer. How do they tie that back to Trump? What standard do you apply? And Alan Dershowitz, I know he's not liked by many liberals these days, but I still like him. And Alan Dershowitz always has this rule, which he says, is the shoe on the other foot rule, which is if it applies to your opponents, would you apply it equally to your friends? So would you say If this was Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, whoever else might, Bill Clinton, whoever might be your Democratic friend, that they should be convicted, prohibited from running for office under the same circumstances. So you can't make a law. Blind justice is blind justice. The scales of justice person wears a blindfold specifically so that they don't know who they're passing judgment on. Why, my big problem with a lot of the legal analysts on TV these days, especially the MSNBC nighttime ones, is they seem to be making up decisions based on who it is that is the victim of their analysis, as opposed to it being, you know, sort of a legal standard they would apply to everybody.
Across the board. Yeah. John, my question to you is, all of this, I mean, all right, so Smith wants the gag order reinstituted. Trump was sanctioned 10K. He could be off the ballot maybe in Colorado. He's losing, you know, Michael Cohen stomped all over him. He's facing losing money elsewhere. None of this is, all right, I say this with this predicate, 28%, according to recent polls, are strong, you know, MAGA Republicans, 28% of registered Republicans, which are 28% of the registered voters. But still, that base is still there, isn't it?
Rock solid. He's not losing ground. Isn't this amazing? If this was any other person.
Yeah, talk about your Dershowitz other foot. That's,
right. If it was any other American politician, they would no longer be a politician. They'd just be cratering in the polls. They'd be at 3%, wouldn't be able to raise a cent. And yet, Mr. Trump, yet again, as he has his entire adult life, gets by and seems to, in some ways, get stronger. But we don't know. The question will ultimately become, 82-year-old Joe Biden at the time, or almost 82. He'll be 81 next month, and then almost 82 on election day. You know, Joe Biden, 82, almost 82 versus, I guess, almost what, 78-year-old Trump with all his political baggage versus Biden, who will have, you know, we've talked about his first term so far here since we started doing this. And that's what the question ultimately will become, is Trump or Biden? And Trump's baggage will be a part of that metric as voters decide what to do. But right now, incredibly, it doesn't appear to be hurting Trump. And it's just remarkable.
In fact, and this is our next bit, and I'll let you unpack that. Mike Pence, his VP, has already suspended his campaign. And
he's out.
And he's gone. And the fact is, as you pointed out last night, I did laugh for about 5 minutes after you texted me this. You know, there are people who didn't even know he was in the race.
Yes, I had a good friend of mine who lives in Michigan and follows politics, former reporter, follows politics closely, and announced to, I guess they had a gathering of kids and parents for Halloween, as I'm sure a lot of our listeners did. And he announced to their friends that Mr. Pence, former Vice President Pence, had dropped out of the primary. And most people in the room did not even know he was running for president. So as I said, sometimes you do feel like you write something or you do a podcast or a radio hit and you wonder, did anybody read or listen? And boy, that's not uplifting either. That's not very motivating, is it? But anyway, that just shows that, you know, folks are out there living their lives, man. They're buying Halloween candy and dressing the kids up. And here we are following all this uplifting news, every twist, turn, and syllable.
And nobody else is.
Right. Nobody else. Right.
Jesus, Mary and Joseph. So you have to wonder, do they even know that Biden has a challenger now? You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Dean Phillips ended months of the worst kept secret in Washington that he was going to run for president. He is running for president. He has a bus and everything that has a wrap on it, that has his name on it. He's running for president. And I will say that this is going to be a huge challenge. Biden has been raising money at a pretty impressive clip. He's got a lot of cash in the bank.
Yeah.
Democrats are doing okay on the money side. That's another thing about Trump that's remarkable is he's able to still raise so much money. This is going to be a very expensive election. Of course, he's using some of that for his legal defense, as Michael alluded to. But, you know, the fact that sorry to go back to Trump, but everything goes back to Trump. it's if any other politician had to spend as much donor money, regular people money, $25, $50 internet contributions on their legal fees, they would be cooked politically. But in some ways, it makes him stronger. But back to Mr. Phillips, I don't know, he's going to run, I think, a more, in some ways, I don't know how he runs a different campaign than Biden to break through. I just don't know how he's going to appeal. Well, I don't know who his target audience is so far.
People who believe that a 54-year-old Bradley Cooper lookalike is a better candidate for president than the 81-year-old current president. And I don't know that he has. All right, Michael, did you know he was around? Did you know who Dean Phillips was before he announced?
Household name in my house. Yeah.
You all talk about Dean around the campfire, do you?
Well, but I thought it was Dizzy Dean. I got completely confused. I'm sorry. With the World Series and stuff, I think first to baseball and they said Dean's running for president. I thought Dizzy or John, who?
When I heard Dean, I immediately went to Martin. So, I mean, I don't know that he is a hope in hell.
So the interesting thing about Phillips's run is that he's entering in New Hampshire and not South Carolina, but New Hampshire. And I think Biden, am I wrong that Biden will not be on the ballot?
He won't be on the ballot. Yes.
In New Hampshire. Correct. So that means that this guy is running in the Democratic primary, unopposed. Essentially uncontested.
Well, what's her name? The other, the crazy lady who's also.
Yeah, no, but unopposed by a mainstream politician. And so a victory there for him will be, written off as it's always easier to win a game against a non-opponent than when another team takes the field. But and Phillips has voted with Biden, the vast majority of the time in office. So I'm not sure as a policy matter where he can, sort of find separation. So really he's saying he's too old. But that's a terrible message, it seems to me, for the Democrats. If this guy's got any viability, if he gets out of New Hampshire or even in New Hampshire, if he's hammering Biden hard on he's too old, and that gets baked in further. I know that's what the Republicans are trying to do, is they're baking in, and the media is going right along with it. The he's too old mantra. And look, you mentioned his name earlier, Earl Warren on the Supreme Court. He was completely capable in his later life, and so are many others. 80 is not 100, and there are young 80s and old 80s, and you can be a frail but sharp of mind 80-year-old. Look at Stephen Hawking, the brilliant physicist who was had ALS and couldn't move anything but like an eyebrow. No one would say he didn't have the intellect to continue to be a physicist because his body broke down. So, I just don't buy it. And I think we buy into this notion. I think the media has been terrible about this. And if this campaign of Phillips, sort of can further bake it in, in media, if you can brand somebody that someone is, Al Gore was an exaggerator or a liar. They remember they tried it. And John Kerry was not really a Swift boat hero. You know, if you can bake in like a product, an image, it's almost impossible to get out of that. And so if this guy Phillips is going to bake in the notion that Biden is too old and Biden doesn't himself agree and step away from his candidacy, which there's no indication that he will, then I think Phillips is going to be helpful to Republican causes. And that, to me, when you have no realistic chance of winning, is, well, then why are we doing this again? What's the point here?
Well, it seems to be all about age and hedging his bets that something will happen to the president and he'll step in and fill the vacuum. But
yeah, but if something happens to the president,
there's Gavin Newsom and there's Kamala Harris before him.
He's not people, you know, the Mrs. Roberts, the nation turns its lonely eyes to you.
Woo, woo, woo.
You know, he's not Joe DiMaggio. People are not going to be turning their lonely eyes to Dean Phillips should there be, you know, a need to find a new candidate in place of Biden because of something.
I think if Bradley Cooper falls down and they need someone to fill his role, that would be Dean Phillips. But
that's... yeah, well, I would take that role before I took the president role. But the point is that I don't understand the point. I don't understand the point. And especially if you think that the election is in 2024 is really, again, an election about democracy. If that's what, and I fundamentally think it is.
It is.
And then who are you, Dean Phillips, who agrees with Biden 90% of the time? Who are you to undermine the chances of electability, especially when now with Biden's stand on Israel, it brings into question Michigan for the first time because of the large Arab community in Michigan. Do those people, if they sit out the election or decide not to vote for Biden and vote for somebody else, does that tilt Michigan out of the Democratic campaign? There's no margin of error in 2024.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if I were in a room with Dean Phillips, I would say to him, you know, essentially, to what end? What is this? What is this really? What do you stand for? How does this promote that? And I don't know that there is an answer to it. And I hope he's asked those hard questions by the media, and that they don't just harp on, well, he's running because he's 54 and Biden is 80, and you know, there is this, you know, and they feed into the narrative of Biden is too old, rather than say, what issues are you running? What is the foundation of your campaign substantively? And specifically, when you have no realistic chance of winning and you have the opportunity to be damaging to a candidate who you agree with most of the time, why are you doing this? I hope that's what they do rather than do the compare and contrast on age. But I have no confidence that the media will do that. They'll harp right on the age thing, just like they jump on every...
Well, wait a minute. Let me ask John about that. John, I'll give you the... You think that we'll jump in and ask that? Michael doesn't think so, but do you?
I think Mr. Phillips will be asked to what end. I think he should be asked, you know, if you are not successful, if you don't win the nomination, are you going to endorse President Biden? And think about that moment where, you know, however long he can afford to stay in the race, and there will be pressure for him to drop out at some point, I strongly believe. You know, what does that look like when he then endorses Biden? How does that work? So I'm like Michael, like, what's the point here? Where are you going with this?
Remember the Carter, that's a good question, because in 1980, that is exactly what helped sink Carter, because he had Kennedy who fought him. And Carter said, look, if Kennedy gets in a race, I'll whip his ass. And he did. But then Kennedy turned around and endorsed Carter and it didn't help him.
Yeah. I just don't know what that looks like. I think it will not be Mr. Phillips, you know, brightest moment when that happens. And I assume it's coming. But I will say this about President Biden's age. I think it is a fair thing for us to focus on as the media. You know, he does have moments where he doesn't make a lot of sense. He, you know, he rambles on kind of like I am right now. And, you know, the end of the week, especially the GERD acts up. We know he has that, you know, very minor medical condition, but it can make him seem every day of 81. And so I do think it is an issue. But to Michael's point, so what, I guess, is kind of the question that voters will have to wrestle with. Once they start paying attention, hopefully they will.
We've got people who didn't even know Pence was in the race.
Once they start paying attention, you know, so what if on a busy week, if Biden, you know, gives remarks in the Roosevelt Room about the economy, the latest jobs report, and he's been busy, and you know, they've woken him up at 2 a.m. twice in that week, and he's been on the road and down to the sit room at 3 in the morning, and he's tired, and he's 82, and you know, he sounds after a busy week like he's tired and 82 and has the most stressful job in the world. But, you know, if he can keep the lid on the Middle East to the extent that anyone could right now, and if the economy continues to be this weird kind of strong that it is, so what if he sounds tired on Friday morning when he gives remarks? As long as the outcomes that his administration is pursuing are solid, and you know, he's not, you know, rambling on and on about nuclear war or something, then you know, maybe voters decide that okay, he's old, but he's still getting the job done. And we don't know how voters really feel about that right now, because again, people just aren't paying attention. They're living their lives, they're sick of politics, and you know, they'll check in sometime this time next year, hopefully before, so they can get a good sense of all this. But I'm just grappling with how much, and I read polls and write about polls in my newsletter a couple times a week, and I'm starting to ask myself that question: how much does any of this matter right now?
Right. Except, John, I think you make an interesting point here, which is, and my beef with the media is that the media will write a sentence that says Joe Biden is 80 years old. This is the media. Joe Biden is 80 years old, period. Instead of Joe Biden is 80 years old, comma, yet he seems still to be getting all of these things done.
That's true.
Period.
That's true.
And you never get that clause that yet he seems to be getting all these things done. You know, sort of question like mine about Stephen Hawkins, notwithstanding a broken body, the guy is still the leading world's physicist. So why does the media keep asking or harping on the age without it, but there is no indication that his age has impaired his ability to be president?
Yeah, I think that's all
you
fair.
Might say, yeah. Well, Gerald Ford slips down the steps of Air Force One, and that's somehow a big story. Or George Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, I think it was Herbert Walker, throws up. That's a big story. Yes. It's just too
in Japan.
Easy. It's we too also, easy.
Yeah. We also don't point out enough. Yeah, I think we also don't point out enough that Trump is as old as he is. He's only a few years younger than President Biden. And
he's in worse shape. He's in worse physical shape. Yeah. You look at the guy, he's obese.
He's in worse physical and mental shape. And I mean, I've been close to both of them, and I can tell you that's not up for grabs. Look, I'm going to draw that one to a close, because before we finish and we've been going on, I do want to get one thing in, because the biggest news of the week for me as a music fan has absolutely nothing to do with politics. And it's something called Now and Then. And that was one of the last times that John Lennon ever saw Paul McCartney. He says, "Hey, my friend, think of me now and then." And he recorded a song with the title Now and Then. And the Beatles have been, well, Paul and Ringo are the only two left, have been struggling with trying to put this together as a single. It's not going to be AI influence. It's going to be cleaned up. It was a piece of music that John had recorded. George had recorded his parts on it. when they did Free as a Bird several years back. So George, Paul, John, and Ringo are all on this recording, and it's being billed as the last song by the Beatles. Does it, do you think it matters, or do you, I look forward to it nostalgically, but after Free as a Bird, I don't know how good it will be musically. That's,
I liked Free as a Bird, and I liked Real Love, the songs that the Beatles put together from the tapes that John Lennon had been working on before he was murdered. But the difference between those and Here and Now is that the recording that Lennon made was cleaner, so they could work with it and put in their parts. Now and then, the recording was not good enough to really salvage, too much ambient noise and stuff. Yeah. But then a new technology recently was developed to allow them to clean it up sufficiently so they could go back to Lennon's early take of it. It was a cassette tape that he had.
Right. It was recorded in his home. Not long before he was killed.
Right. And they were able to clean out the background noise. So you do have a clean John Lennon singing and the other Beatles participating in it, because they worked on it back then in the Real Love Free as a Bird sessions. They just couldn't clean it up enough to have that be the third song back then. So I'm very excited about this. The notion that there's a new Beatles song coming on
in 2023, right? 60 years after they first hit the scene.
I think it's great.
I think it's great. I think it's great nostalgically. John didn't grow up in that era. I'm a first generation Beatle fan, and I know that Michael is too, but you're not. So what do you think of it?
I think it's great. Get it out of here.
You know who the Beatles were, right, John?
Yeah, I stepped on one once.
Yes.
But that's there was a song called the Beatles Stomp.
That's E-E-T. Right. This is E-A-T. Sorry. Yeah. The beat.
Yes, I am familiar with the works of the British pop rock band known as the Beatles. And by the way, Paul McCartney's band that was not Wings was Wings.
Yeah.
I know that much. So I'm not completely ignorant.
You knew that Paul McCartney was in another band besides
ignorant of pretty much everything else, but not not that.
Well, but seriously, when you hear this as the kid on our trio here, does it give you a shoulder shrug, or does it say, well, this is going to be very cool?
This is going to be very cool. I was going to ask you guys, when is this being released?
November 2nd.
November 2nd. I will be listening. I will be all ears, and do not snicker. I see you both laughing. You're looking in my ears right now.
Well, then let's talk about it next week. By the time we
not since Ross Perot. Not since Ross Perot.
That's right. Ross Perot, Barack Obama, and me.
And don't forget LBJ. No, that was him picking up the beagle by the ear. It says, now and then will be preceded by a 12-minute making-of documentary the day before its release and a music video the day after, which includes electric and acoustic guitar recorded in 1995 by George, Ringo's new drum part, and bass, guitar, and piano from Paul, which matches John's original playing, according to the announcement. And McCartney also added a slide guitar solo inspired by Harrison, as well as backing vocals from Starr in the Chorus. I look forward to it. I hope it's a little bit more up tempo. Free as a Bird and Real Love were a little ballady, but I would love to see this as a more up tempo thing. But I do. What strikes me is simply the saying, you know, that it's based on John Lennon's last conversation with Paul when he said, you know, think of me every now and then, my old friend. And so that brings a tear to my eye and hope to my heart. And with that, we've been going on. So we're going to have to close it off. But I thank you guys. It was a lot of fun. John, hit what you like, brother. What are you promoting?
Rollcall.com. Check out I guess they'll let me write a column. It'll be up on Friday morning.
There, you guess they will, huh? <Who knows? laughs> And Michael, your turn, brother. Plug what you want.
So my podcast is called That Said with Michael Zeldin. It's a book-based conversation with a lot of different interesting authors. But one of the things I wanted to just mention in respect to the podcast, and you think of Now and Then, the John Lennon, Paul McCartney, Think of Me Now and Then. On my podcast, if people want to go back into the history, there's a wonderful interview with a guy named Sandy Greenberg. His book is called Hello Darkness, My Old Friend. And
I come to talk with you.
As we know, that's a Simon and Garfunkel line. And I invite people to think about Now and Then when it comes out, and then go back into my podcast and listen to the Sandy Greenberg Hello Darkness, My Old Friend album, book rather, and then we can talk about it at a future date. It's a great story. Good.
And the name of this podcast is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. We thank you for joining us, and we will catch you next time.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.